Joe F. from Cleveland.
All right, all right. Hello, everybody. My name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. There's only one reason why I'm here tonight, and that's not because of me and all my abilities of being a real alcoholic and great guy, but it's a result of you people. If it wasn't for you people, I wouldn't be here. And so I hold that dearly. I hold that dearly, what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, and it's not just primarily something that I've done by myself. Because when I came into AA, I definitely needed the help of a lot of other people other than Joe. And, you know, so here I am. My sobriety date's February 2nd, 2000. And I'm sober. I'm a free man today. And that's the greatest gift that I've ever received was the gift of sobriety. And I can't stay sober on yesterday's sobriety, so I have to maintain focus. And I have to maintain vigilance on the principles of this program and my contact with you people. And this is my conduit to my higher power. AA is where I go to see and experience my higher power. Nothing really too original that I've learned or that you might hear tonight. But I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and I grew up with a beautiful single mother and two beautiful older sisters. And I was the youngest boy, and, I was considered a latchkey, I guess, where there wasn't a lot of rules. There wasn't anybody really primarily home all the time. And, I grew up in a neighborhood where all the families knew each other. And say, if I come home from school and there's nobody at the house and the door's locked, and one of the neighbors would take me in. I got my best buddy, and I definitely grew up with a generation where there was no cell phone use. So it blows my mind to see, you know, the people mesmerized and attached to this device. And, luckily I was a little predated that, where, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood where we did things. We just, you know, we had a group of kids, and we ran around, rode our bikes, played ball, and just went around. And how I grew up is not why I'm an alcoholic. Because what I've learned is that there's people who have grown up in completely different environments with rules, with two parents, that are alcoholic as well. So this disease doesn't discriminate. You know, the reason why I'm an alcoholic is because when I picked up that drink, I fell in love. I fell in love with it. It did something for me, like Aaron mentioned. It was the effect produced that just made me feel like I just found the elixir of life. You know, whatever life was about, I found it in this bottle. And that was a deal. And in fact, I remember I started at a young age, 12, 13, I remember getting drunk with a buddy of mine, and I'm just like going, hey, this is great, right? Like, I'm feeling this is the best feeling in the world. And he was like uneasy and unrest, and he was not having a good time. And it took me years sober to look back at some of these events that happened to realize, wow, you know, he's non-alcoholic. He's a normie who the first time had the effect produced by alcohol, he didn't like it, and he probably didn't drink for years after that or ever. You know, and me, it's something that hit me, and I had to run with it and, fell in love. I grew up, like, compared to the other kids in the neighborhood, way different lifestyle. You know, I had a single mom who worked all the time, and two older sisters who, you know, after high school, because there was no parent, guess what? They're bringing all the high school kids over, and they're throwing down. And, my mom liked to party, too, at times. So I was around people drinking at a young age, and I romanticized that, you know, because whatever these adults were doing looked like it was fun to me. And I'd be 8 years old just planning and plotting and just trying to obtain, you know, what they would be a part of, what they were a part of. And so in a way, I was planning I was just planning. When is it going to be my turn? When is it going to be my turn? And didn't take long. I, 13, picked up a drink. and I took off running with it. A couple things that happened at that time when I had fallen in love with alcohol, my life, Joe's life, ceased to exist with Joe's potential or Joe's decision. You know, the thing that happened was the obsession took off, where the only thing I cared about was when, where, and how am I going to get drunk? Who am I going to be hanging out with? Who do I got to, you know? My neighborhood friends that I grew up with and ran around in diapers with, they ceased. You know, when I picked up drinking, I no longer had common interest with those neighborhood kids anymore. You know, because they're saying, hey, you want to go to this high school football game? And I'm like, well, you guys ain't drinking. I don't know. I'm like, no, you know. And so I immediately found people, and it didn't take hard. I mean, it wasn't hard at all. So I was the young one who was always hanging around people 4 years older than me, who had cars, and, you know, I was an everyday bar drinker at 17. It was easy, because the guys that I hung out with who were 21 knew the bar keeps, and guess what? I walk right behind them, they'll serve me. In fact, I remember one night, I'd go to this bar regularly. You know, I was the type of kid who worked hard and, you know, worked hard and played hard. And I went to a bar regularly at 17, and I remember, now this might have been a couple of years later when I was turning 21. No, but I was dating a barkeep that was working there, and the two owners of the bar were ex-cops. And so I'm celebrating my 21st birthday for the third time, whatever. And she goes to the barkeep's like, hey, you know, Joe's like, he's only turning 20. And they're like, yeah, he doesn't cause any trouble, like, whatever, you know. And it's just, you know, it was easy for me to drink. I just knew how to find the people, places, and things that were going to provide for what I needed. You know, when, where, and how am I going to get drunk? That's all I thought about, drinking. You know, this is my life. People are like, what do you want to do in high? What do you want to be when you grow up? And it seemed like a good idea after watching this music video documentary. Led Zeppelin came out with this song, Remains the Same. It was this Madison Square Garden show from, like, 75. And I watched it, and I was like, I want to be a rock star. I want to be like Jimmy Page. And, you know, and then I bought a guitar and I started playing, and then I started studying all, you know, all the classic rock. And it seemed like one thing in common, a lot of the people's music that I looked up to and studied, the one thing in common is like they were all dropping dead at 28 and heavy partiers. And I'm thinking, well, if I'm going to achieve that goal, I need to know how to party like these guys. And the only thing that made me was just a professional drinker, you know. And, you know, high school coasted by, you know, my mother. The only person I fear in this life is my mother, who's 4'11", Sicilian, and just like, her eyes open up like, and you know, you can't say anything or talk back. And she said a couple things. She said, look, you know, my son's not going to be a high school dropout. And if you're not doing anything with extracurricular activity in school, like, you need to get a job, you know, because I'm not going to see you just flop around on the couch all day. And so that kept me under the radar of getting into trouble throughout my high school years, you know, because I was working hard and I was on my way to graduate. And it seemed like people didn't, you know, as long as that was going all right, people didn't really, you know, get on my back. You know, it's just high school. They show up, hang out with people afterwards, you know, drink. And during the summers I would work and hang out with the older crew and go out. So a couple stories qualifying. I'm really not one that likes to qualify. You know, the important thing about sobriety for me is, you know, the type of wreck I was. And really, the important thing is, how did I change? When did that change come into my life in order for me to accept this help that was here, right? But here's a qualifying story. So I'm 13, and there's in Little Italy in Cleveland in August, there's this Feast of the Assumption. So it's a weekend blowout. It's a big drinking fest, right, for all these Italians. And I got a – so I'm 13, and I'm on a mission. I'm like, I'm going to ride my bike down there, and I'm going to cop some wine and get drunk. So I ride down – and I, you know, all by myself, and I find this alley, and they're selling, you know, red wine that's the twist off, and so I'm like 13 years old, and here I'm like, this is my first time, so I go around, and I'm like, and it was my mother's friends, right, Peggy, and they're like, you know, selling it, and so I'm like, so I said, I'm like, oh, Peggy, you know, and she's like, Joey, and I'm like, hey, I want some wine, and she's like, you know, gives me two bottles, and so I slip around, you know, the alley, drink two bottles, and I get a good buzz, and walking around, and I'm like, you know, I probably should get to my bike and ride home. As I'm going down the hill, my sisters are coming up with their friends, and I was thirsty, I was dehydrated, it was a hot summer night, two bottles of red wine. And my sister and her friends are coming up, and Jimmy has this bottle of Sprite, and I'm like, dude, I'm thirsty, man. Let me hit that. He's like, here. And so I take a huge swig, thinking it's Sprite. It was Absolut Vodka, right? And so then, because what they used to have lemonade stands, and like they would get lemonade, pour half of it out, and pour the Absolut in. And needless to say, I was like really needing a race to my bike, because I knew at that point, if I didn't get on that bike or home quick, it was going to be trouble. And, drinking wherever it was going on. I didn't discriminate on where I drank. You know, if there was a party, let's go. And, what happened was, drinking, it began to my experience with drinking was an immediate consequence. It was slowly progressing to a point where, you know, obviously I was dealing with a lot of fear and resentment that I didn't know about. And I would drink in order to alleviate, those feelings. You know, so with me not knowing how to handle my fears or resentments or proper communication with others, drinking it masked my issues, and it dug a deeper problem within myself. Meaning that in the late stages of my drinking, whatever fear I had was extreme paranoia, whatever resentment I had was extreme rage. I was an alcoholic crackpot, you know. And then the kicker was alcohol ceased to work. There came a point where I crossed the line, and I remember it was up 48 hours, and there used to be a time where I could just drink myself to oblivion and pass out. And there was a time where I drank 48 hours straight, and I still wasn't like, I just was like, couldn't get there, that needed to be, you know, oblivion and passed out. And that's the line I crossed. Alcohol ceased to work. And at that point, there's nothing good to come. I was, trouble for me started when I moved out of the house at 18. And I'm thinking, you know, people, I had opportunity. You know, I had my father and my mother try to pull their sources together and say, hey, listen, we're willing to help you. However, in order to get your life together, if you want to go to school, whatever. And, at 18, I'm like, no thanks, you know. I'm going to go, work with my buddies. I'll figure it out in a year. And what happened was from 18 to 20, I had like 20 geographical cures within a 5-mile radius of Cleveland. And I had the greatest intentions to travel the world and to be, just go, you know, be free and go. And I couldn't, you know, that was not happening. So there came a point where 20, I'm basically on the brink of homelessness. I'm thinking the people I'm staying with are, hitmen. I got the CIA after me, the FBI watching me, and hitmen following me at every corner, right? And or so I'm thinking. This is what's going through my head. And I was just in trouble. Life unmanageable. So the only thing I knew how to do was to call the person who brought me into this world. I called my mother, and she says, huh. I said, things aren't feeling right for me. Things aren't going good. And she's like, really? And so she says, okay, well, me and your father have been thinking you have a drinking problem. So we'll look into a place to see if we could get you in so you could get help for your problem. In the meantime, you're not coming home. And so I was like, all right, what was my option to be? Thanks, Mom. Like, the streets is a good idea. So she calls a couple of days later and says, hey, there's this place, the Freedom House. And basically it was a place where old members of Alcoholics Anonymous bought real estate and would have these houses, and they would pull drunks in and give them a place to stay, and they would show them, this is what active members of Alcoholics Anonymous do. They would practice the principles that were taught to them to these people that they brought off the streets into the house. So at that point, I didn't have any other, I had back problems and the heat was on, and I had to accept going. I couldn't stand it. I despised having to go to the Freedom House. 20 years of age, I was working night watch on New Year's Eve one year or whatever it was. It was New Year's Eve, and I'm working night watch, just miserable. That I'm like in the Freedom House, in this halfway house, watching New Year's Eve, watching million of people partying around the world, and I'm stuck in this halfway house trying to think that I'm going to get sober. I was surrounded by a lot of ex-convicts, people who had war stories about jail institutions, and here I'm a kid who likes to play guitar and drink a lot and go out clubbing and hit the town, and just didn't think that I had really a lot to identify. But so I stayed 7 months, and going to meetings every night, not really paying attention, and in the back of my mind, whenever all this pans out, I'll drink again, but I'll manage better. And eventually that happened. I get out. It wasn't long. I call my old friends. They're going to some shows. I'm going to go to be the designated driver, and they're coming up with 12 packs and cases, and either I was going to run as fast as I can down the street away from them, or I was going to pick up and partake, and that's what happened. So I started drinking again, and didn't take long till trouble came swinging around. The crazy thing about the disease is it really affects the people closest to you, and the sufferer, the alcoholic sufferer, has no idea what we're doing to others, When my sister later tells me, yeah, we really thought like we were going to, like, that phone would ring late at night, and she'd pick it up hoping that it wasn't the call that Joey was going to be dead, right? Just ridiculous things that I put people through that I didn't have a clue how I was affecting, and my behaviors was affecting others around me. As a result, being an alcoholic, what I learned is I lived in the kindness of others. I was a grown adult at 19, 20, 21, where my parents were already having kids and careers and doing like mature things, responsible things. And I'm living in the kindness of others, not knowing how to manage my own affairs, grow up, take care of myself, and just thank God for them. Thank God for the people who stuck with me through the hardest times, because who knows where I would have ended up, Freedom House, that's a stint. I ended up drinking. So the next place for me to stop was, they said, well, you tried treatment, that doesn't work. You're not breaking the law or doing anything crazy. We can't put you in jail. So how about, you might have some mental issues. How about, uh, How about we bring you in for a 72-hour psych evaluation at CPI? And I'm like, all right, cool. Like, oh, this is about to be a vacation, right? I need, like, a break. And so they take me to CPI, which was Cleveland Psychiatric Institute. It was a state-funded insane asylum. And so I'm like there for 72 hours, and I'm like, I'm gonna play reverse psychology on these doctors, right? Because I'm all smart and all that. And so they're running down the list, you know, what's your name? How old are you? And my questions are like, my answers are like crazy. You know, what color's your hair? Blonde. What color's your eyes? Blue. Who's the president? Abe Lincoln. What year is it? 2050. Are you a smoker? Yeah. How many? 4 packs a day, right? And so, you know, I do that night. The next morning, they're like, hey, Joe, come up to the nurse's station. You weren't allowed to smoke there. So they're like administering my patch, right? So I eat breakfast. They're like, hey, you know, we're going to administer the patch. I'm like, cool. So I put this patch on. And within 3 seconds, I'm like this. And like sweat's profusely coming down, and like my breakfast comes up, and I'm like overdosing on nicotine because I wasn't a 4-pack smoker. I was like maybe a 1/2-pack smoker, but you know, me, you know, saying, yeah, I'm a 4-pack smoker, they administer that heavy of a dose. So who wins, right? So, and that's just, you know, it's many, like, you know, I've been drunk 13 years, I've been sober 16 years, and there's like a lot of experience that I've had, both that I could explain, but you know, with speaking, you just kind of gotta, you know, come, whatever, I just, you know. And so 72 hours passes, and I go up, you know, the 73rd hour, like, hey, like, I'm ready to roll, right? And they're like, well, the doctors don't see it fit that you leave. And I'm like, well, that's not like, that's, you sure? Because I was told that it was 72 hours. They're like, yeah, you need to stay. And so, so reality hit at that point that maybe I should just show these people that I'm not like, that I know how to shower and I know how to communicate. And, you know, so like, they weren't going to let me out with no place to go. So I had to stay another 3 weeks. And then I had a place to go. And then I went to that place. Then I had to go back, right? And so that was happening. It was a revolving, you know, it was, my drinking was, you know, it came to that point that I was an alcoholic crackpot at 20, in between 20 and 25, I was an alcoholic crackpot. At such an early age, beginning drinking and drinking as heavy as I did throughout my teenage years, my brain became mush. Literally, it just, like, I understand wet brains now. Like, I didn't understand the concept of wet brains, but I do. I understand that, you know, it destroys, you know. And so to speed you up, you know, within a year and a half, I was admitted into CPI 3 times. And the third time, and it was never Joe's plan. It was never Joe's plan to go back to the Freedom House. Well, I didn't go back to the Freedom House, but it was never Joe's plan to go back to the insane asylum after I left that first time. And I found myself, bam, in, bam, you know, third time, and I'm walking the halls, and the nurses are like, we hope we don't see you again. And like 6 months later, they're like, hey, they put you on the same ward with the same people. And you know what? And I had a moment of grace. You know, and it was from, I had a psychic change. It was from my higher power. I didn't know it at the time, but I'm walking down the hallway and I'm just like, you know what? Man, this is bogus. You know, I was like, look at where you're at. You know, this wasn't your plan to be here. Here you are again. And I said, hey, Joe, maybe this is all your fault, dude. I said, maybe everything everybody's been trying to tell you for the last 5 years, maybe they're right and you're wrong. And I was able to get honest with myself to put the blame here. There's only one problem in this room right now, and it's right here. Because with or without me, this meeting would be kicking off just as it was going to kick off, you know. And so then at that point, with that honesty, I was able to become open-minded to begin to listen to what others were going to say to me. And then I was going to be, and then I became willing to do and to listen, you know, to what people were telling me. And that was the beginning of my journey with sobriety, was the how of the program. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. If I didn't have that, I wouldn't be sober today, because I didn't have it in the 5 years prior, you know. And that's something that I couldn't have fabricated on my own. You know, I truly believe that it came something greater than myself that kind of zapped me in the head to be like, you know, recalibrate the way I was thinking. And so, ironically enough, the Freedom House, which was on my four-step inventory, and all these old-timers that I despise, there was a mustard seed planted in this drunk's head, because when that moment came, I knew exactly what I needed to do because it was taught to me back then. Go to meetings every day. Be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Change your playmates. Do what we do. And I said, all right, I'm going to give AA 1 year of my life. That's my deal. 1 year of my life, I'll give AA. And when it's bogus, like I'll prove to you, then I could drink freely and run my life a wreck anyways. And so out of all the acquaintances I had, you know, my drinking buddies and all my friends, they probably had enough of me anyways. They were sick of me. But, you know, the thing is, one person called me. Out of all the people that I hung out with, one person called that didn't see me for a while and said, hey, Joe, what's up, man? I heard you were gone, just starting this business, wondering if you wanted to work. And I said, look, I said, I need to really, you know, focus on this AA stuff, you know. If I'm, you know, within a year, whatever, man, if everything's going good, I'll start working for you. And he's like, cool, man, call me whenever, you know. So what I did is I immediately changed all, you know, I said I have to immerse myself in AA. So I started showing up at meetings, and I was sick. I was a sick, sick, sick drunk, you know. I was the type of drunk that walks in the room and, like, most people go to the other side. And we're like, people are fellowshipping afterwards. They don't even want an earshot here, like, if I seek, and they're not even welcoming me, you know. I mean, I was that type of drunk. But thank God for the old-timers who showed me their time, because there was a couple old-timers that knew me better than I knew myself. And I come stumbling into AA, and they're like, hey, you know, and I'm like, well, I don't want to really talk to you, dude, you know, like, there's other people here, and they're like, you're just a punk, you know, and shape up, and you know, but the most important thing I realized is they were giving me their time. The sickest person that walks in the room, there's a couple people that are like, hey, you know, where most people are afraid and just like, eh. And that's a truly miracle, you know, that I'm grateful for. You know, these people that this path has been paved for us, right, by other members of AA. And I have to show my gratitude for the ones that walk before me, because AA is not guaranteed. There was an old timer, you know, my best friend in AA was a guy, an old timer, who got sober in 56, knew Sister Ignatia. And, like, met Bill, and he'd be, you know, his thing was, like, I was a couple years sober, so I was approachable, you know, when I met him. But we were buddies, you know. I'd come Friday, he'd have a seat saved for me. And we don't even save seats in Cleveland, but he had one saved. We were right by the door, and he would basically flirt with all the younger women. I would flirt with all the older women, you know. But then he would just share his experience, you know, his life, you know, being a World War II paratrooper. And here I'm, you know, we're completely different walks, but we were like best friends in the meeting. And, you know, he would be like, we'd stand up to pray and hold hands. And he'd go, Joe, so when did everybody start holding hands in AA? You know, like, he got sober when, like, I guess, you know, just people stood up and said their prayer. But, you know, all the old-timers that passed on their experience to us. And there's one guy that said, AA's not guaranteed to exist. AA's not guaranteed to be here 10 years from now, 20 years from now. And this guy was really heavily involved in service with helping drunks, you know. And, man, he said, you know what, 5% of, 95% of the work in AA gets done by 5% of the people, you know. And he said, and he always just wanted to say, hey, listen, if you're in AA, be in AA. You know, be a part of this thing, do things, you know. I can't, there's no gray area for me in sobriety. Like, I couldn't come into AA and be like, yeah, I'm going to come in 3 days, 4 days a week, and then I'm going to go hang out with my friends and do that whole deal. I had a set of ideas and behaviors that dominated my life that wasn't working for me being a drunk, right? I had to change, and luckily those old ideas and old behaviors changed into a whole new set of ideas and behaviors that dominated my life into this way of living. And the principles that I learned here, which are far more healthier than the ones that I had prior. And the only way I was going to learn it was from you people, you know. The people in the meetings that angered me the most were my greatest teachers. Because what was I going to do? Drink at you? You know? And I remember there's this old timer. He'd always, you're a punk. Yeah, you're nothing. And I'm fighting with him. You know, being like a month sober, like, rah, we're like two alpha dogs. And I'm just like, who are you, you know? And I remember gripping the steering wheel, driving home from a meeting. And I'm like plotting revenge on this dude, right? I'm like, man, this dad went too far. You know, he went too far tonight. I'm going to, rah, rah. And then my, you know, here comes my higher power, just, and then the thought crossed my head, hey, Joe, you know, I bet you, like, right now, how you're acting towards this guy, I bet you that guy right now is, like, sound asleep. And he's sleeping like a baby, you know, and look at you all bent out of shape. And what I learned was, do I want to be right or do I want to be happy? You know, because being a drunk, I felt like I got to be right. And what I learned here is I don't have to be right. I could be wrong. In fact, in order for me to be here, I was way wrong because what I was living was not right. And, you know, I immersed myself in. I went to meeting every night. And, you know, there were beginner's meetings before the speaker meeting. And, you know, slowly but surely, you know, the first thing I heard was, if you're new, get to meetings early, set up, shake hands, get numbers, 90 and 90, you know. People would come up, hey, do you have a sponsor? I'd say, I'm doing 90 and 90 right now, you know. And I'll tell you this. There was one, I want Wayne to have it up here like this. And be like, oh, that's close. He'll be like, bah. One real quick story. I go to this meeting. There's a coffee guy. And I show up there. I go to him. I say, hey, by the way, I heard if you're new to get the meetings early set up, and I'm here. And he's like, all right, I'll show you how to set the chairs up. And I'm like, all right. And so he shows me, and then he goes to the kitchen. He's like, I'm going to make coffee. And I go, wait a second, dude. I said, where's everybody else? I was like, there's 50 people that come to this meeting. Why is it me, the crazy new guy, that's got to set all these chairs up for you flowery people, you know? And he's like, you came here early. They're on their way. And so I'm throwing chairs around, you know, like setting the meeting up, mad that it's just me. And they said, keep doing it. You know, what I learned was that was really what propelled me into this gift, was being a service. It was until that I learned that I need to come to AA. What can I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous instead of what can I take? You know, because I was a taker. So in order for me to give of myself, to set up chairs, to shake hands, it was all me, you know, bringing something, you know, to the meeting place, which I received. It was an order, you know, for me, I had to learn to give to AA until I could receive from AA, period. And, you know, and they would say, do this, do this. And I'd say, all right, I'm going to do it to the, I did it to every meeting I went to, I set up. I'd pick up cigarette butts with my hands, you know. People are like, put your cigarette butts in the cans provided. I'd go out, there'd be cigarette butts everywhere. I'm like, even like 2 years sober, I'd talk about it. I'd be like, how hard is it? You know? And, you know, but I did it. I benefited. Yeah, I benefit. Like, throw them on the ground. Yeah, I'm going to benefit from them, you know. Like, leave chairs for me to do. I'm going to benefit from it. And so if you're an AA, there's no gray area, you know. Do the deal. And, you know, my deal was, you know, this was never Joe's plan. If you would have asked me February 1st, 2000, where I'm going to be, the furthest thing from my head would, I'm going to be a member of AA one day. This was like never Joe's plan, man. Like my plan was never to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. But fortunately, I've been given the gift. AA's been truly amazing. I can't even, you know, what I do want to talk about is what I've been able to do from a kid who had a geographical cures, 20 of them within a 5-mile radius of Cleveland. I've been able to travel across the country and some of the world as a result of AA. And I have friends all over the continental United States. I was in Issaquah in LA. I was in Issaquah in San Francisco. I was in Issaquah in Portland, Detroit, Orlando, Atlanta. I was in 3 world conventions, right? I was in, Toronto was the first, San Antonio and Atlanta. And that's the most amazing. I come back home after going to the world convention. People say, how was the convention? I said, you know what, dude? If I die, like, I'm good. Like, I've seen everything I need to see in this life. I'm good, man. Like, AA's taught me how to grow up. AA's teaching me how to live. And more importantly, it's teaching me how to die, you know, with grace and humility. And you know, it's just a huge gift. I mean, I can't. You know, my best friends in Philadelphia, right? We had our 10th year in Atlanta, Georgia. We had our 10th year anniversary of going to a convention together, right? We started in Toronto, San Antonio, Atlanta was our 10th year. In between that, we went to Issaquah and other conventions. And, like, that's, we have the best time, you know, for three, four nights, man. It's just like, definitely recharges my battery to hit the daily grind, you know. And, you know, so I have to stay vigilant, and I have to take my sobriety very seriously. You know, there's a lot of fun in being sober. The most fun I ever had in my life was being sober. But this is life and death, man. People die. In fact, more people die as a result of this disease than get sober. You know, I mean, I look at, like, going to a home group meeting of mine back home for 10 years and seeing the same faces for 10 years compared to the hundreds of people that have came in and out of those meetings, and it's like, what, 5%? The amount of people that stayed. But it's a huge gift. You know, I'm grateful, and it's a huge honor to come up here and to have been able to share with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous what's been given to me by you people, you know. So if you're new, stay, get busy. You know, if you're 2 years sober, become a GSR, you know, get involved. I learned a lot about, the only time I learned about the traditions was truly when I had a service sponsor being a GSR. You know, about it, truly, you know, anonymity or this and it's just been a great ride. So anyways, there's more. I mean, there's a whole bunch more, you know. There's a whole lot of more stories and experiences. But, you know, unfortunately for now, I'll just leave it with that. And thank you all for patiently sitting and just close it down.